This is Martin Mortel, Director of UK and European Research with Glass Lewis. Today I'll be chatting with a number of Glass Lewis analysts by way of our 2018 European proxy season preview. Over the course of the next 40 minutes or so, we'll be discussing developments in non-financial reporting, as well as looking at the ongoing shift in expectations about how issuers respond to shareholder dissent. First up, though, I'll be looking at the topic of board composition and diversity with Natasha O'Connor, who manages our UK and Nordic research teams, and Chris Rushton, who leads our Germanic research team, both of whom have spent a great deal of time in recent months engaging with issuers and investors across Europe on this and other topics. Given that board composition and performance are critical to a company's success, it's essential for our clients that boards be aligned with their company's long-term strategy. As such, Chris and Natasha's discussions with issuers have revealed board composition to be an increasingly important focal point for investors when assessing corporate governance at investee companies. However, it's clear that discussion of board composition and diversity has grown ever more nuanced over the past year. Chris?
Thanks, Martin. While discussion on board composition over recent years has focused primarily on gender diversity, which is a topic that hasn't gone away, the increasingly circumspect investing environment means the investor gaze is adjusting in order to better assess board diversity in a much broader sense. It's become a mainstream belief that having an appropriate mix of certain attributes on the board, in particular skills, experience, diversity, and independence, is essential to ensure that the board as a whole can satisfactorily perform its oversight duty, have informed opinions on all the topics relevant to the company, and effectively advise management on important strategic decisions. Particularly given the increasing legal requirements for directors in most markets, investors' expectations of boards have never been higher, with a perceived role evolving from watchdogs to strategic leaders.
In the UK, for example, the information provided in directors' biographies has traditionally been confined to a paragraph or a blurb. These essentially read like an abridged CV, and they comprise of a list of past appointments with an emphasis on board-level experience, past and present. Recently, however, we've seen a marked increase in the number of companies that are conveying the skill sets of their directors in terms of their relevance to company strategy and board operations. Moreover, companies are providing enhanced disclosure regarding board evaluations, succession and nomination processes, along with the everyday workings of the board. An example from the 2017 proxy season would be Hammerson PLC, whose reporting included a section on board activity and insight into the year. This featured details of their meeting agendas, results of board effectiveness reviews, along with personal reflections for several directors. Complementing this disclosure was a half matrix showing what key skills exist on the board and how many directors fulfill each skill. By steering away from boilerplate disclosure, shareholders are afforded a deeper understanding of how the board works and why it's composed the way it is.
While UK companies are probably leading the way at the moment in terms of board skills disclosure in Europe, in terms of developing best practice, I'd say the German market will be an interesting to watch during this AGM season. It's only really very recently got to the point where shareholders could actually expect to regularly see extensive and up-to-date biographical information on current and proposed directors from German companies. There's a new co-recommendation that came in last year, which recommends to companies that they should create a skills and expertise profile for their board, which they should also take into account when there are board election proposals at an AGM. From what we've seen already, this has led to quite a marked increase in discussions on board composition and refreshment in the disclosure of German companies. The German Code Commission itself has stopped short from recommending how companies comply with this recommendation, so we believe there will be quite a lot of variety in the information provided and a range in how useful it will be, but we expect to see most companies complying with this recommendation. From the engagement discussions we've had recently with German companies, we believe that many of them will be fairly cautious with their disclosure this year and will be monitoring how best practice develops in this market. A fairly common concern we've heard from issuers is that when information has been disclosed once, there's no way to step back, and investors will then expect to see that level of disclosure every year. As such, while we believe that the code recommendation will probably push German companies to become front runners in board skills disclosure in Europe, it could take a few years before we consistently see meaningful information provided across the board. For the time being, at least, early indications suggest that most German companies will primarily focus on disclosure of the key skills and experience that the board wants to have represented, while stopping short of providing information on how and to what level individuals on the board possess these. However, we have already seen quite a few exceptions of companies who have noted the value of extensive and clear disclosure and have gone beyond this mark. Aside from Germany, many other companies across the continent have been carefully considering their diversity disclosure following the transposition and applicability of the EU Directive on Non-Financial Reporting. This requires large publicly listed companies in the European Union to disclose diversity policies for their boards in their 2017 corporate governance statements. While the directive itself and the transposition by the member states has left quite an amount of room for companies to decide how to comply, our discussions with European issuers have led us to believe that many are taking this exercise seriously and that this has been a fairly common engagement topic in the past year for them. Another interesting case in the coming season is likely to be the disclosure provided by Italian boards. So in the past in Italy, shareholders would have been asked to choose between lists of board candidates prepared by major shareholders and institutional shareholders at the AGM. But with growing participation at Italian meetings and some shocks in the last few years, a number of Italian companies are amending their bylaws to permit the board to also put a list of candidates up for election. So many of the Italian companies that we've spoken to recently that are intending to follow this route, they've been telling us that they do intend to go as far as disclosing a full skills matrix for their current and ideal boards in order to provide extensive rationale for their choices to shareholders and gain support for their lists.
So, given this focus on board composition, how do our analysts plan to approach things this season, Natasha?
In conducting board analysis, Glass Lewis looks for certain skill sets. So, for example, financial expertise on the audit committee. And it recognises the value of industry-specific knowledge complemented by a broader diversity of skill sets and experience. With growing investor focus on the composition of the board of directors, Glass Lewis has been developing its approach to both assessing and communicating information on the skills and experience represented on the board to its clients. The goal was not only to promote meaningful context, but to do so in a transparent manner. While considerations on the board and committee composition have always formed part of our director election analysis, for proxy season 2018, we are introducing a new board skills matrix into our analysis across a number of markets. This is in order to have a more structured approach to assessing board diversity.
It's our view that a board skills matrix can be a valuable tool for assessing a board's mix of skills and experience. Not only can it assist shareholders in understanding where additional accountability for certain issues lies on the board, it can also give a useful insight into the director nomination and succession planning process, providing more context on how the board is shaping itself for the future and how any new nominees to the board fit into the bigger picture. We believe that a board skills matrix can help shareholders make a more informed decision on whether to support the election or re-election of directors, and it can also be utilized as a basis for discussions on board refreshment and composition with issuers. From my engagement discussions in the past few months, I've noticed that quite a number of issuers seem to view this increasing interest from shareholders in board skills and experience primarily as just a further disclosure requirement, something that they have to do for their shareholder base without really recognizing how it could actually benefit the company too. Looking at the voting policies of large institutional shareholders and the case-by-case decisions they make when deciding whether to support director elections, it seems almost self-evident that when shareholders can truly understand the value and the specific role of each director on the board, they may be more likely to overlook relatively minor concerns with individual directors. In particular, recent open letters and policy updates from large asset managers such as BlackRock and Vanguard highlight that an assessment of diversity on the board is becoming an integral part of their board analysis. As disclosure best practice in this area is rapidly evolving, Glass Lewis is refraining from recommending to companies exactly how they should present this information to shareholders. But our minimum expectation is that companies should disclose sufficient information to allow a company outsider to conduct a meaningful assessment of a board's skills and competences. If a board does fail to address material concerns regarding the mix of skills and experience on the non-executive element of the board, we will consider recommending the shareholders vote against the chair of the nominating committee or the equivalent that the board has in place.
Last year, we piloted the skills matrix on a smaller scale. We covered the largest five issuers from three sectors in the FTSE 100 based on their market cap. The feedback we received was positive, so from 2018, our analysis of director elections at the following groups of companies will include board skills matrices in order to assist in assessing a board's competencies and identifying any potential skills gaps. In the UK, we're going to cover FTSE 100 companies, excluding investment trusts. In Germany, DAX companies that will be holding supervisory board elections at their 2018 AGM. For Switzerland, all non-controlled SMI companies with a market cap of greater than 20 billion Swiss francs. For the Netherlands, AMX companies with a market cap of greater than 20 billion. Spain, the IBEX 35 companies with a market cap of greater than 20 billion. In Italy, the FTSE MIB companies holding supervisory board elections in 2018. And finally, in France, all non-controlled CAC 40 companies with a market cap of greater than 20 billion.
Companies have been categorized across five broad sectors: financial, industrial, consumer, pharmaceutical and healthcare, and resources. Further, each skill matrix will comprise of five core skills, skills that we believe should probably be represented to some extent on all boards. So these would be core industry experience, financial audit and risk, public policy and regulatory, legal experience, and senior executive experience. Furthermore, there will be three sector-specific skills from the following list. So cybersecurity and IT, environmental and sustainability, health and safety, international markets, M&A and capital markets, energy, oil and gas, and finally, manufacturing and supply chain.
Have there been any notable trends thus far?
While the information that companies are providing on board diversity is improving rapidly, it's still fairly rare to see a coherent link between this disclosure and the board's refreshment activities. In the case of new candidates being proposed to the board, the biographical information provided is generally sufficient to understand that the individual is suitably qualified to serve as a director, but it still often remains difficult for company outsiders to understand why a particular candidate was chosen over a plethora of other qualified individuals that could serve on the board instead. We find it be quite useful for shareholders to understand how the company believes new candidates will fit into the overall profile of the board and which skills and experience in particular the board is hoping to leverage from them.
From our engagement efforts, we have found that many companies have a board skills matrix, or at least sight of one through a recruiter, and this is how they identify potential skills gap for succession planning. Interestingly, when we've asked them why they don't include it in reporting, they have stated a belief that shareholders wouldn't find the information useful.
Another common concern I've heard from discussions with companies is the belief that explicit disclosure on the board's assessment of how skills and experience are represented is seen as being fairly sensitive, given that individuals on the boards may disagree with how they're being assessed. While this form of disclosure will probably be the most useful to shareholders in our view, we understand why some companies are reluctant to follow this method. However, we have seen some interesting solutions adopted by companies that still provides meaningful disclosure to the market. For example, if the board is able to clearly outline its skills and experience assessment methodology and discloses the number of directors it believes possesses this attribute, this still gives shareholders a good overview of the level at which the board believes skills are represented without the risk of treading on any of its directors' toes.
While we haven't collated enough data to come to a firm conclusion, a trend we have noticed in the FTSE 100 is the lack of cybersecurity experience among the non-executive cohort. Risk competence seems to be in abundance, but since cybersecurity represents a unique emerging threat to companies, particularly those with multinational operations and a repository of sensitive information, we would expect boards to address this going forward. However, we acknowledge that given the niche nature of cybersecurity, many issuers have advisory boards or consultants who deal with these issues for them.
Natasha, Chris, thanks for your time. I'm back with Simona Rubino, an analyst on our Central European research team, and Matti Jäkälä, who leads our Iberian research and engagement efforts. Together, we'll be discussing developments in board accountability with special regard to the quality of a board response to shareholder dissent during AGM season. Like many of our clients, we view a board's responsiveness as a key indicator of a company's culture and the efficacy of its directors. We also believe the board should be aligned with shareholders' expectations and that poor transparency and accountability can act as a barrier to effective stewardship on the part of investors. As a global firm, we are well positioned to share best practice in this regard, which we do via our ongoing engagement efforts and which we hope to do with this podcast. Matty, what's the current state of play in the markets you're most familiar with?
Unfortunately, we see a relatively poor responsiveness in markets such as France, Italy and Spain. Public disclosure regarding boards' engagement and its effect on board decisions following even significant dissent has so far been very rare, practically non-existent. In Germany, as the meeting minutes are disclosed, we see that particularly blue chip companies usually address the dissenting vote in the annual meeting. But in general, these markets, when it comes to responsiveness, it depends on ownership structure and extent of the dissent. 20% against is not usually enough for prompting changes. You would need a dissent of at least 30 to 40%. However, high against votes are addressed differently depending on the proposal type. When it comes to the election of directors, the vote is practically not discussed at all. There is very little evidence that anything is changed. Sometimes, if there is a specific concern with the director, such as overboarding, the company may address this issue and any steps taken. But in general, for an outsider without access to boardrooms and no significant disclosure, it looks like if a director gets elected, that is pretty much end of the discussion, no matter what level of support they have received.
What do things look like on the remuneration front, Simona?
Across all markets, the most controversial proposals remain say-on-pay proposals. Companies are more open to changes when the issue is disclosure rather than the structure of the remuneration system. Sometimes the reason for a poor disclosure is simply that issuers don't know what they should be disclosing. Cervet set a distinctive precedent when became the first Italian company to have its advisory pay vote rejected with 54% of shareholders opposed. The result was largely the product of the board's failure to clearly explain the compensation structure or to disclose its key features. To be fair, this was the only second time that Cervet had prepared a remuneration report for shareholders' consideration, and it showed. However, the board took the AGM outcome seriously. As a result, a completely renovated remuneration report was submitted at 2017 AGM, where it was approved by 86% of shareholders. When it comes to changes to the remuneration structure instead, we must note that in most European countries, with the exclusion of Switzerland, where we see better disclosure, even after a significant against vote, companies don't always make changes. And when they make them, they might explain these changes in detail, but very rarely the dissenting vote is addressed directly.
Everyone likely remembers what prompted the approval of the Sapin II law in France. That was the Renault case in 2016. Full implementation of the law will be rolled out this year in France. It amounts to what is probably the most restrictive say-on-pay legislation in the world, and its background is in the fractious relationship between Renault and French state. Before Sapin II, say-on-pay votes were advisory, as in many other European countries. However, when Renault failed to get approval for its CEO's remuneration and got into a very public spat with French government, legislation was implemented. Since then, Renault barely managed to keep its head above water in its 2017 AGM. It saw the highest opposition to both its policy and remuneration report, with against votes of almost 50% of voting shareholders.
Are there any other interesting examples you're aware of, Simona?
At Telecom Italia, for 2 years in a row, the remuneration policy barely passed, mainly because of a special long-term incentive award for its CEO. The company did not show much interest in engaging on the topic, and the results at 2017 AGM showed. An interesting fact is that the letter of the chair of the Remuneration Committee included in 2016 annual report, there was no mention of the over 14% vote against received. Now, the former CEO, Flavio Cattaneo, resigned and the company will have to set a new remuneration policy and justify to shareholders any termination payment to the former CEO. Sometimes, where there is not a say on pay on the ballot, shareholder frustration may spill over to a different proposal. At its 2016 AGM, SAP advisory vote on the compensation report received only 51% approval. No changes were made, and the outcome was not addressed by the company in any public filings, and shareholders not offered another advisory vote. In 2017, Glass Lewis recommended that shareholders vote against the ratification of the supervisory board because they had not sufficiently responded to shareholder concerns and had therefore not sufficiently represented shareholders. This proposal, which usually is supported by shareholders with close to 100% approval, received only 51% support.
Have we gleaned any insights on the issue from our conversations with issuers, Matty?
First of all, there has been a huge increase in engagement, also from our part in recent years, and we believe more disclosure can now be expected regarding questions that concern shareholders. Sometimes companies show some level of frustration or difficulty to get the message across to shareholders regarding their specific circumstances, and unfortunately, companies still more often than not tell us that they do not know the reason for the dissenting vote. This also brings about the question of how companies engage and is it effective. One thing to consider is whether any members of the board are involved in engagement or is it just investor relations team and management meeting with shareholders. For example, Spanish Corporate Governance Code recommends that lead independent directors maintain contacts with investors and shareholders to hear their views and to get a better understanding of their concerns, especially on corporate governance related issues. While some companies believe that because of the independent nature of the lead director, it is better that they are not in contact with the investors, from our point of view, although with a limited sample size, the engagement meetings we have that include a lead independent director or alternatively remuneration or nominating committee chair are fruitful in the sense that they seem to have a good grasp on the views of the shareholders and reasons for any concerns that could later manifest in a growing against vote.
If we talk about issues that have come up recently with our meetings with issuers, besides remuneration proposal, which as we heard can be controversial, we now see in Spain, Italy, Netherlands and Germany a growing opposition towards general share issuance authorities that limited the issuance without preemptive rights to 20% of the issue share capital. This is, for example, the recommended limit of the good governance code in Spain. Same goes with the repurchase and the reissue of shares authority in Italy that generally have 20% limit but tend to get high against votes depending on shareholders' base. From engagement, we hear that some companies have made note of this development and have indicated that they will lower this threshold to 10%, considering the lower thresholds of institutional investors. The limits for these general authorities are already lower in UK and France. In Spain, some companies like Bankinter and Applus already last year presented proposal with the exclusion of preemptive rights limited to 10%. And there is a sense that if a company is going to look for an authority to issue shares with a higher limit, they need to present a specific proposal or start improving the disclosure on how they are planning to use this authority. This is still an issue that varies a lot from company to company, and some issuers seem unsure about the reason of the high against vote, but it's something that maybe companies can prepare to with effective engagement. We have not changed our general policy for continental European markets, where we expect general authorities to issue shares without preemptive rights to be limited to 20% to issue share capital. But it's something we'll be looking at closely this season.
Matty, I believe there are some interesting developments afoot in the UK.
Some changes are proposed to the UK governance code, which is currently out for consultation and is to take effect from the 2020 AGM season. One of the changes would require companies to explicitly address any shareholder dissent above 20%. So when more than 20% of votes have been cast against the proposal, the company should explain what actions it intends to take to consult shareholders in order to understand the reasons behind the result. An update should be published no later than 6 months after the vote, and the board should also provide a final summary in the annual report or in the meeting documents for the next meeting. Also, the UK Investment Association now maintains a public register of shareholder dissent on their website. The register was included in their response to the UK government's green paper on corporate governance reform, and the government asked the Investment Association to develop and maintain this register. The Investment Association suggested that the register would be created as investors are more and more frustrated by often boilerplate disclosure and little acknowledgement of the issues behind the significant against vote. It is an aggregated list of publicly available information regarding meetings of companies in the FTSE All Share who have received significant shareholder opposition to proposed resolutions or have withdrawn a resolution prior to the shareholder vote. The aim is to highlight these companies and to understand the process they use to identify and address the concerns of their shareholders. We will see how this name and shame approach will affect the responsiveness of UK companies, and will it be a deterrent for other companies with similar concerns?
Coming back to season, what's going to inform our own approach to assessing board responsiveness to shareholder dissent?
We consider that board generally has an imperative to respond to significant shareholder dissent from a proposal at the general meeting, and this particularly in the case of a compensation or direct election proposal. We continue to take into account the company's shareholder structure when considering what constitutes significant dissent, and we generally expect responses in cases with more than 20% dissent. We have lowered this level of opposition from 25 to 20% for this proxy season. Our recommendation here is not advocating that companies make changes, but stress that companies should be proactive in addressing dissent from a significant portion of the shareholder base. For company outsiders that do not engage and maybe only consider the company in detail once a year, support below 80% of the free float is an immediate red flag for which they look for further information to try and understand the issue when making voting decisions.
Dissent that grows year on year often becomes more of a protest vote at lack of responsiveness of the board rather than being based on the original issue at hand. Further disclosure on what changes have been made or explanation of the status quo and when no changes will be made shows outside shareholders that the board is taking their concerns seriously and can cover gaps in transparency and the rationale which may have led shareholders to take a negative vote in the first place. We believe the board committees are responsible for insufficient response to shareholders' concerns. When it comes to compensation-related proposals, we will recommend voting against all members of the compensation committee if the say-on-pay proposal was approved, but there was a significant shareholder vote against the proposal in the prior year, and there is no evidence that the board responded accordingly to the vote, including actively engaging shareholders on this issue. Similarly, in case of election directors, we may recommend voting against one or all of the nominating committee members up for the election when the board fails to respond to a significant shareholder vote against previously elected nominee. While we do not lay out specific disclosure expectations for companies, we do encourage public disclosure on the engagement efforts and on the fact that the board has acknowledged and understood the shareholder views.
I see. Great, guys. Thanks for your time. Much appreciated. Next up to discuss the topic of non-financial reporting, we have Andrew Geblin, our Senior Director of Research for Europe and Latin America, and Kian Whelan, one of our UK analysts who has a strong interest in this particular area. Andrew, why is non-financial reporting in the spotlight in Europe this year?
Well, Martin, for the first time, 6,000 of the largest European issuers face requirements to report on non-financial issues, including environmental protection, social responsibility, human rights, anti-corruption and bribery issues, and board diversity. While all of these can be considered non-financial issues in terms of traditional financial reporting paradigms, investors and regulators increasingly recognize the financial impact of failing to monitor these risks or harness related opportunities. This is a result of the EU Directive on Non-Financial Reporting from 2014, which only fully comes into effect in 2018 in all EU member states for the 2017 fiscal year, meaning that companies are required for the first time to report this year. Knowing that new requirements have been coming down the pipeline has already spurred many issuers to act prior to this year, so that they have the advantage of having refined their approaches in advance of these new requirements coming into effect. Through engagement with investors, employees, and other stakeholders, issuers who already got a head start have improved the quality of reporting and aligned their metrics with the most material sustainability issues facing their companies. Investors are under pressure to improve their understanding of these risks as well. And this has been highlighted by recent scandals over pay, governance, and environmental issues at a number of companies, including UK house builders, European banks, and oil and gas companies more generally. Even so, while some European companies have developed sophisticated ESG or sustainability reporting in recent years, not all have. This new standardized requirement for reporting means that simply reporting on these issues no longer makes a company a market leader.
So what is it that does make a company a market leader in Europe in terms of non-financial reporting?
Well, standards for reporting vary widely, and there is no consistent baseline. The EU directive sets a very broad standard for issuers, and no member states have opted for a substantially more prescriptive approach. The report on non-financial issues can follow a template provided by any international, European, or national guidelines to comply. It's a very broad set of standards. CSR Europe and the Global Reporting Initiative, or GRI, issued a comprehensive report on the implementation of the directive in member states in November 2017, showing that most countries adopted the directive's wording on reporting templates without amendment. Companies can disclose their expanded reporting on non-financial issues through their annual report or through a separate statement on their website. This also needs to be signed off by the external auditor, but only insofar as the auditor must acknowledge the existence of the report, not actually audit it. Only a handful of member states, including the UK, Denmark, and Italy, actually require that the auditor provide any substantive review of the content of the report. So, coming back to your question, as for being a market leader and developing best practice, only those companies that exceed the actual reporting requirements are blazing somewhat diverging paths forward. Some issuers have embraced the integrated reporting framework, for example, providing a robust discussion of how the company's strategy intersects with its external environment, creating long-term value by leveraging natural and social capital responsibly and efficiently. This can be paired with more prescriptive international data-oriented frameworks that emphasize consistency, including the GRI standards or the Carbon Disclosure Project, also known as CDP. Companies with the best reporting have developed a consistent standard for evaluating and capturing data on relevant environmental, social, and governance KPIs, which in reality can and should vary by company. The Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, also known as SASB, provides a good example of an industry framework that some issuers have used to evaluate material KPIs. Finally, companies with the most advanced reporting have certainly provided some assessment of their strategy against the UN Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs.
I see. Well, that's quite a lofty goal. Kian, what exactly are the UN Sustainable Development Goals?
Well, the Sustainable Development Goals are a collection of 17 goals set by the United Nations as part of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. They were launched in 2016 as a follow-on from the Millennium Development Goals. The 17 goals include 169 targets and cover a wide area, from eradicating poverty to conserving and sustainably using ocean and marine resources, promoting just institutions, and taking urgent action to combat climate change. The goals are deliberately interdependent, Achieving one will generally require working toward multiple others, and they are universal. Developed and developing nations have roles to play in achieving the goals. In announcing the goals, a great deal of emphasis was placed on the importance of the private sector. Publicly listed companies in particular are identified as having an important role to play, and the investors who engage with these issuers are being encouraged to emphasize the importance of issuers considering how their business can incorporate the SDGs. Importantly, though, this isn't a case of issuers committing acts of charity once a sufficient margin of profit has been achieved. There's a strong business case for integrating the SDGs. Issuers that take this process seriously open themselves to identifying future business opportunities and untapped markets, and adopting a more holistic risk management horizon as we approach a situation where more and more externalities become internalized through legislation, taxes, and the public accessibility of information up and down the value chain.
So, from the investor perspective, the relevant question may be to determine whether and how an issuer has assessed its own business in line with the goals.
Well, there are two ways that investors can look at an issuer. They can look at their reporting and their governance processes around that reporting. If we first consider reporting, a good starting point would be to look at some of the guidance that has been published to assist issuers in integrating the SDGs. One useful resource is the SDG Compass. The SDG Compass provides guidance on how issuers can align their strategies and also measure and manage their contribution to the achievement of the SDGs. The SDG Compass offers a practical process for identifying the SDGs most relevant to a given issuer and selecting appropriate and measurable indicators that can be integrated into the business strategy and day-to-day operations. So, for example, if an issuer were to map their value chain and identify certain areas where they can have maximum impact, they might identify water consumption as an area of significance. That might lead them to look at Sustainable Development Goal 6 to ensure access to water and sanitation for all. The next step, then, is to choose an appropriate indicator that will enable the issuer to collect data, measure progress, and effectively communicate that to stakeholders, including investors. On the SDG Compass website, they have a pretty extensive database of indicators and reporting guidelines. So if you search for indicators relating to SDG 6, you'll see an indicator for average water intensity in water-stressed or water-scarce areas, and a link to the Corporate Water Disclosure Guidelines. So this issuer now has an indicator that can be integrated into their business strategy, disclosed to investors, and measured over time. Differentiating issuers with more meaningful reporting can still be a challenge for investors. Having recently contributed a systematic evaluation of strategic and sustainability reports in the FTSE 350 to reporting awards by ICSA, the UK Governance Institute for Corporate Secretaries, we have some experience in this regard. We found that the best indicators of good reporting were a clear and consistent template linking ESG KPIs to the issuer's business model, with multiple years of reporting. Issuers referencing how their KPIs contribute to the UN SDGs that are most relevant to their business tended to have the most comprehensive, understandable reporting. The key here is selecting the most relevant SDGs and KPIs for the business, therefore emphasizing quality over quantity of reporting.
Is there any consensus on what best practice is with regards to SDG reporting, and are there any companies leading the way?
Well, a very good resource is something that the UN Global Compact and KPMG published called the SDG Industry Matrix. The industry matrix highlights industry-specific examples and ideas for how issuers can contribute to the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals. The industry matrices are quite interesting in that they recognize that different industries will be in different positions to contribute to different goals, but nevertheless, each goal is conceivably important to every industry. For example, the SDG industry matrix highlights the work of Aviva, who released a carbon strategy that included commitments to continue to explore ways to integrate carbon risk and actively seek to collaborate to publish new research and insights, target a £500 million annual investment in low carbon infrastructure for the next 5 years, also targeting carbon returns alongside financial returns on its investments, and setting an associated carbon savings target for this investment of 100,000 tons of CO2 annually, and actively engage with companies to achieve climate resilient business strategies. So as far as reporting goes, there you have a number of commitments and targets across a range of time horizons that are ambitious yet practical. Really, the thing that gets stressed again and again is that the SDGs are adaptable. So rather than emphasizing a certain outcome that would be amenable to a box-ticking review, I would say it makes more sense to look at the processes that the issuer used in arriving at their particular outcome.
And how does all this tie into governance oversight?
In 2018, Glass Lewis will, for the first time, consistently assess board-level oversight of ESG issues for larger companies globally in our proxy papers. In reviewing these companies, it became evident very quickly that there is a high level of diversity when it comes to the kinds of governance structures that different issuers were using. For example, Royal Mail PLC disclosed in their CR report that its CEO has overall responsibility for corporate responsibility, and members of her leadership team take responsibility for each of the major strands of its CR agenda. This is fairly typical of companies who have management-only governance of ESG issues. One thing to note is that the accountability goes right to the highest levels of the company, which is a good sign. However, there's a strong argument to be made that ESG issues ought to have some degree of board-level oversight. An example of this sort of governance structure is Intertek Group PLC. Intertek disclosed in their CSR report that the board has overall accountability for Intertek's sustainability and CSR, while the group-wide strategy and implementation are the responsibility of senior management. The distinction that Intertek make between accountability and implementation is interesting here because it aligns the oversight of ESG issues with existing governance practices. Another way that companies are integrating ESG oversight into existing governance structures is by appointing dedicated non-executive committees. BAE Systems has a corporate responsibility committee with its own terms of reference, clear lines of responsibility for social, environmental, and ethical issues, and an entirely independent membership. A dedicated non-executive ESG committee has the obvious benefits of independent oversight and has the additional benefit of providing a clear point of contact for stakeholder engagement.
So, focusing on corporate governance practice, have we noticed any trends developing amongst the issuers that we've been reviewing?
Overall, according to our review, around 50% of the FTSE 100 have a standalone committee just for ESG matters, and about 20% have management-only ESG committees. The remainder used a wide variety of different kinds of governance structures, including entire board oversight and designated directors. Really, there's no right or wrong answer. However, what is important is that issuers disclose why they have chosen the governance structures that they have chosen. ESG issues are still an evolving concept. They are informed by hard finance as well as values, meaning that miscommunication is an ever-present danger. Consistent lines of dialogue through engagement activities will go some way towards avoiding miscommunication. But what's really important is consistency of language and clarity of concepts. And that, arguably, is where the real strengths of the Sustainable Development Goals come in. They provide a shared vocabulary and framework that enables effective and efficient communication between all stakeholders, including between issuers and investors.
So it sounds like practice varies quite widely from company to company. Andrew, what do you expect issuers to actually do with regard to ESG oversight?
Well, Martin, at this stage, we believe that best practices for reporting and ESG oversight are really still emerging and cannot be thoroughly assessed on a consistent basis from company to company. However, we maintain that there is a very clear difference between issuers who have been thoughtfully engaging on sustainability topics versus those who are just following regulatory requirements. At a minimum, we expect companies to demonstrate some level of engagement with their shareholders and other stakeholders, to identify material KPIs and the relevant reporting frameworks that are meaningful to them. This is actually quite evident in the quality and cohesion of reporting, even if there is inconsistency from company to company. Further, we expect all companies to clearly describe the mechanisms for oversight of ESG risks, opportunities, and reporting. Our preference is for some explicit level of board oversight, but we do recognize that for many companies, this is still a work in progress, as Kian has talked about. Where companies fail to even address this topic in public disclosure, they are clearly behind the curve and potentially exposing investors to unnecessary risk due to poor governance controls.
So what are investors actually doing, and what do they expect from companies?
In our experience, most large institutional investors are still developing their own frameworks for reviewing sustainability issues, including the SDGs and their expectations for non-financial reporting. Those investors that are slightly ahead of the curve are regularly engaging companies on these topics in order to better understand ESG risks and opportunities. This shift in thinking is really evidenced in the annual letter to CEOs from BlackRock's CEO, Larry Fink, who is encouraging investees to think about how they make a positive contribution to society and how they operate with a sense of purpose that benefits all stakeholders. In Europe, some investors have expressed even more specific views on their expectations of issuers. For example, Eumedion, the Dutch corporate governance forum for investors, has asked through its annual focus letter that investees align sustainability objectives and executive KPIs with the sustainable development goals that are most relevant to the firm. In addition to upping expectations through public statements such as those from BlackRock and Eumedion, investors are also starting to exercise their influence in more visible ways. Although some feel more comfortable with a wait-and-see approach, others have already moved to take more decisive action. Using screening tools such as those offered by our partner Sustainalytics, many investors are proactively identifying risks in their portfolios in order to engage with companies on ESG topics, sometimes pushing for better reporting and sometimes for an actual change in practice or governance. Where engagement fails to yield results, some shareholders are now escalating those concerns to votes against directors, remuneration, or even the accounts and reports, flexing their muscle in new ways to demonstrate that they really mean what they say about long-term sustainability.
I see. Good to know. Andrew, Kian, thanks a million for joining me.
This recording should not be considered a solicitation of proxies by Glass Lewis. Glass Lewis has not sought permission to do so from the SEC, nor will it. This recording is for information purposes only and should not be construed as providing investment advice. In addition, Glass Lewis makes no representation regarding the accuracy, completeness, or reliability of any statement of any of our speakers in this recording. If you have any questions, please contact us via our website, www.glasslewis.com.